This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Education as a Force for Social Change. Lecture 6, given in Dornach on August 17, 1919. Yesterday, I discussed the path human intellect and intelligence will need to take in the future. I based that discussion upon specific facts brought to light through spiritual scientific activity, a few of which I want to mention today. In a practical sense, you need to be aware that when a human being stands before you, that human being is the being of whom we speak in Anthroposophy. As you know from my book, titled Theosophy, that means we must always be aware that we have a being of four aspects before us. We have the I, the astral body, etheric body, and the physical body. Although we have these four aspects of human nature present each time a person stands before us, from the common point of view, modern people actually do not know what is before them. People simply do not know. They think what stands before them is the physical body. However, we cannot see what is physical in the physical body in the same way we normally see things with our eyes. What we see with our eyes as the physical body and the way it stands before us, we see only because the etheric and astral bodies and the I, capital, permeate it. As strange as it may sound, the physical body is only a corpse during our life between birth and death. Only when we have a human corpse before us do we, in truth, have the physical human body. When you see a corpse, you see the physical human being without the etheric and astral bodies in the eye. They have left the physical body, and we can, therefore, see it in its true nature. You will have an incorrect picture if you believe the physical human being is something you carry around with you in physical space. Your picture will be much more correct if you think of a corpse and realize that your eye, your astral body, and your etheric body carry that corpse around. An awareness of the true nature of the human being will become more and more important in our time. Things were not always as they are and have been for quite some time in the present stage of human development. Of course, we cannot derive the things I tell you through ordinary physical science, however. Spiritual scientific understanding shows them to be so. If you go back to the 8th century before Christ, which, as you know, is the beginning of the 4th post-Atlantean period, you would be in the Egypto-Chaldean period. At that time, the human body had different characteristics than it does today. The human bodies now displayed in museums as mummies were in subtle ways quite different from human bodies of today. They carry within them a greater plant-like quality and were not nearly the complete corpse of the modern human body. In their physical constitution, human beings were much more similar to a plant, whereas, since the Greco-Roman period, the modern human physical body is more similar to the mineral kingdom. If through some cosmic wonder we were to receive the same bodies as those of the Egypto-Chaldean population, we would all be ill because we would have rampantly growing tissue within our bodies. Many illnesses are caused by the fact that the human body sometimes atavistically returns to the state that was normal in the Egypto-Chaldean period. Today, tumorous growths occur in some people because a portion of their body tends to become like the entire body of the Egypto-Chaldean. This has an important connection to human development. As human beings, we now carry a corpse around with us. However, the Egyptians did not do that. They carried something similar to a plant around with them. The result was that their understanding of things was different from ours, and their intelligence functioned differently than does ours. I would ask you to consider carefully the question of what it is that people understand through modern science, a science of which they are so terribly proud. It is only death. Science repeatedly emphasizes that normal intelligence cannot comprehend life. Some researchers believe they will someday completely understand the complicated combinations of atoms and molecules and their interactions with life by performing more and more chemical experiments. That will never happen. Through chemistry and physics, we will understand only what is mineral and dead. That is, we will comprehend the living only to the extent it is a corpse. In spite of everything, human cognitive intelligence is a part of the physical body, that is, a part of a corpse. What does that corpse we carry around with us actually do? It brings us the furthest in mathematical and geometrical understanding. Everything is transparent there, but things become ever less transparent the further we go from mathematics and geometry. That is because today the human corpse is the cognitive aspect in us, and what is dead can comprehend only what is dead. The etheric and astral bodies and the I do not play a role in modern human cognition. They remain in the dark. If the etheric body could perceive in the same way that the physical body perceives what is dead, it would perceive what lives in the plant world. That is what was so remarkable in the plant-like bodies of the Egyptians, namely, that the Egyptians could perceive the plant world much differently than modern people do. We can trace much of our instinctive understanding about the plant world back to Egyptian insight arising from their instinctive consciousness and embodied within their culture. We still base much of our modern botanical, medical knowledge upon the traditions of ancient Egyptian wisdom. You know that a number of so-called lodges, not founded upon genuine fundamentals, call themselves Egyptian lodges. That is because they look back to Egypt when they want to impart specific knowledge. However, that knowledge is no longer very valuable. In such circles, traditions based upon wisdom obtained through the Egyptian body still live. As people slowly moved into the Greco-Roman age, the living human plant body slowly died. The human plant-like aspect died during the Hellenic Age, or at least was gradually dying then. We carry a dead body within us, and that death is particularly appropriate for the human head. I have mentioned from numerous points of view that initiates perceived the human head as a corpse, as something dead, as something in a continuous process of dying. Humanity will become more and more conscious that we perceive only through a corpse, and therefore we perceive only things that are dead. As we move into the future, an increasingly intense desire will arise to again perceive the living. However, people will not be able to perceive the living through normal intelligence, bound, as it is, to a corpse. Many things must happen for people to regain the ability to penetrate the world in a living way. Today we need to understand everything human beings have lost. When human beings moved from the Atlantean period into the post-Atlantean period, they could not do much that modern people can do. For instance, since a certain time in your childhood, each one of you can say I to refer to yourself. You say this I quite without a feeling of respect. In the course of human development, I was not always said with such lack of respect. In earlier periods of human development, and this was still partially true in ancient Egypt, although it had to an extent subsided, there was a name that expressed what we now express with the word I. But when that name was spoken, it stunned people. For that reason, they avoided saying that name. If the population living just after the Atlantean catastrophe had experienced the speaking of that name for the I, a name known only to initiates, all those who heard it would have been stunned. They would have collapsed because the name for the I would have had such a strong effect upon them. That fact still resonated into ancient Hebraic time, when only initiates were to speak the unspeakable name of God, or to present it to the population in a kind of eurythmy. The unspeakable name of God originated in what I just told you, but humanity gradually lost that feeling and the deep effects arising from it subsided. During the first post-Atlantean period, the I had a deep effect. In the second post-Atlantean period, the astral body had a deep effect. In the third post-Atlantean period, the etheric body had a deep but at least bearable effect, one that brought people into a relationship with all creation, as I mentioned yesterday. Now we can say I and all sorts of things, but they no longer have an effect upon us, because we comprehend the world through our corpse. That is, we comprehend the dead, the mineral part of the world. However, we must regain the desire to return to those regions where we can comprehend the living. During the Greco-Roman period, from the 8th century before Christ until the middle of the 15th century, all human development moved toward ever greater dead understanding of the corpse. Now intelligence moves along the path I spoke of yesterday. That is why we must resist naked intelligence and must add something to it. In a way, we need to properly retrace our path. During the 5th post-Atlantean period, we need to learn to perceive the plant aspect, in the 6th, the animal aspect, and only in the 7th, the true human aspect of life. Thus, the task of modern humanity is to move beyond simply understanding the mineral to understanding the plant. After you have understood that, consider who most exemplifies a person seeking that plant knowledge, Goethe. To the extent that his activity was contrary to that of conventional science and its preoccupation with things dead, and instead moved toward the living, toward metamorphosis and the development of plants, he was a man of the primitive beginnings of the 5th post-Atlantean period. If you read Goethe's essay of 1790, quote, The Metamorphosis of Plants, unquote, you will find that Goethe gradually attempted to comprehend the plant, not as something dead or complete, but as something developing from leaf to leaf. You will see there the beginning of the kind of understanding we should seek, particularly in this 5th post-Atlantean period. Thus, Goetheanism sets the basic tone for what we should seek during the 5th post-Atlantean period. In a way, conventional science must awaken in the Goethean sense, and must move from concern with things dead to those living. That is what I mean when I continually repeat that we need to move away from dead abstract concepts and into living concrete concepts. What I said yesterday and the day before was basically a description of the path along which we can move into living concrete concepts. We cannot move into such concepts and ideas if we do not unite our views of the world and of life. Today, under our particular cultural circumstances, we have to allow the differing streams of our worldview to course, disconnected, alongside one another. Consider for a moment how a person's religious worldview often runs disconnected alongside his or her scientific worldview. Many people have the one and the other, but build no bridges between them. They often have a kind of fear or anxiety about creating these bridges. But we must be quite conscious that things can remain so no longer. During my present visit with you, I have discussed how egotistically people now form their worldviews. I said that modern people's interest lies primarily in the life of the soul after death. And it is purely out of their egotism that their primary interest lies in that direction. I described how we must slowly redirect interest toward the life of the soul, beginning at birth, to the extent this is a continuation of life before birth. Were we to consider the development of the child in the physical world as a continuation of prenatal spirit and soul existence, with the same interest and desire to understand now reserved for life after death, our understanding of the world would take on a much less egotistical character than it has today. However, the selfish character of our present worldview is related to many other things. At this point, modern people need to gain greater clarity about the true basis of that fact. Until now, human beings have primarily developed selfishness. The I has permeated both the world perspective and the will. We should have no illusions in that regard. That has occurred most conspicuously in the religious confessions. You can easily see that religious confessions have become egotistical. Consider, for example, how modern preachers are taught to deal with human egotism. The more preachers take people's selfishness into account and make promises about the life of the soul after death, the better they achieve their goal. Today, people do not really have much interest in anything else. They certainly have little interest in that living, spiritual activity that previously existed in the spiritual world and is now so wonderfully visible in the soul after birth. The way members of the various religious confessions think about God is the result. That they place God in the highest position does not, in fact, say very much. What is important is that we remove all illusions in that connection. What do most modern people mean when they say God? What kind of being do they refer to when they speak of God? What they mean is an angel, their own angel, which they call God, nothing more. People still have a vague feeling that they have their own guardian spirit, which they look up to and call God. Even when they do not call it an angel but God, they still only mean an angel. That people do not get beyond an angel with their concept of God is due to the egotism of the religious confessions. The reason for that is the narrowing of interests caused by egotism. We see the limitations of interests clearly in modern public life. What do people often ask about today? Do they often seek to understand the fate of humanity? Today it is very sad to speak to people about the fate of humanity. They have no idea that these things have changed so much in a relatively short time. You can, for instance, tell people that mighty spiritual battles, the like of which humanity has never before seen, will follow the war of the past 4 or 5 years. Those battles will occur because those things the West calls Maya or ideology, the East calls reality, and what the East calls reality, the West calls ideology. Today you can draw people's attention to such important facts, but they have no awareness that saying the same thing 100 years ago would have affected people's souls such that they could not have freed themselves of it. That change in humanity, people's indifference regarding the fate of humanity, is one of the most visible phenomena. Nothing affects people today. They accept the most comprehensive, decisive, intense statements with indifference and are hardly bothered. That is because people's interests are increasingly limited by a stronger and stronger intellectual egotism. Thus, even though we now have such good democracies and parliaments, when these parliaments assemble, questions concerning the fate of humanity do not arise, because the people elected to parliament have little concern for the fate of humanity. Only selfish interests arise. Everyone has his or her own selfish interest. People form groups based upon the similarities of their superficial professional interests. When such groups become large enough, they form majorities. Thus, questions of human fate do not arise in parliaments or other representative forms, only egotistical questions multiplied by so and so many people. Even religious confession has moved into the realm of egotism, because only egotism lives in modern human beings. Religious confession will experience the necessary re-enlivening only when human interests become broader, that is, when people can look again beyond their own personal fates to that of humanity. Religion will be enlivened only when people are again strongly concerned when someone tells them that a different culture blooms in the West than in the East, and in the middle still another than at the poles of East and West. People must understand what it means that people in the West seek the great goals of humanity, when they seek them at all, by turning toward mediums who enter a kind of trance, thus inducing a semi-conscious, sub-earthly connection with the spiritual world. Western people then allow such mediums to inform them about great historical goals. You can say that as often as you want in Europe, but Europeans do not believe that there are societies in the Anglo-American countries that attempt to find mediums, to get them into a trance, and then to obtain answers about the great fate of humanity through cleverly posed questions. Western people will also not believe that in the East, people do not seek answers to questions concerning the fate of humanity through mediums, but through mystics. Today, that is so real you can almost touch it. Everywhere you can find the beautiful speeches of Rabindranath Tagore, in which you can read how people from the East think about the general goals of humanity. Westerners read those speeches the same way they read a column by some hack writer, because they cannot tell the difference between a newspaper hack and someone of such great spirituality as Rabindranath Tagore. People are unaware that different cultural groups live next to one another. I have spoken for years in my public lectures about what is important for Middle Europe, but none of it was understood as was necessary. The intent of what I just said was to indicate the possibility of becoming aware of things beyond our own fate, of things connected with the fate of groups of human beings, so that you can concretely differentiate between them. If you raise the sight of your soul to an understanding and comprehension of humanity throughout the earth, and attain an intense interest for things beyond your own personal fate, you create within your soul a capacity to comprehend something higher, something more real than an angel, namely an archangel. You will not have thoughts about the nature of an archangel if you remain only in regions of concern to egotistical human beings. If preachers give sermons only out of the realm of selfish human beings, they can speak as much as they want about God and divinity, but they actually speak only about angels. That people call them something else is simply an untruth, and does not change the situation from what it in fact is. Only when you begin to acquire an interest in human fate, connected with space, can your soul come into that attitude that lifts it to understand an archangel. Let us now go on to something else. Feel within yourselves the impulses arising from the various stages of human development. Feel within yourselves the fact that a large number of our present leaders were educated in classical schools during the time the human soul can receive a certain kind of flexibility. They were educated in those schools that arose not out of our modern culture, but instead out of a previous culture, that of the Greeks and Romans. If the Greeks and Romans had done as we do now, they would have created schools based upon the Egypto-Chaldean culture. They did not do that. Instead, they took their subject matter directly from life. We, however, take it from a previous period and educate people accordingly. This has significant consequences for human beings, but we have not recognized them. Had we recognized its significance, then the women's movement would have a different tone than now exists. The women's movement would sound a note that would convey something like the following: we send men to antiquated schools to develop a particular capacity of intelligence, and thus their brains become hardened and embittered. As women, we have had the good fortune of not being allowed into such schools. We want to give our intelligence its original timbre. We want to show what we can develop for the present when we do not deaden our brains in youth with a Greco-Roman education. That tone does not exist. On the contrary, the more common tone is that we have subjected men to Greco-Roman education, and now we women want that too. We too will receive a classical education. People have so little understanding for what is genuinely necessary. We need to understand that in our modern time, we are not educating people for the present, but for the Greek and Roman period. That is why that culture is still so prevalent in our lives. You can feel it. You can feel the Greco-Roman culture living in our leaders of the present time. You can feel it living in what people call intelligence and in intellectuals. That is one attitude living among us today, something we carry in the entirety of our mental development. We cannot read a newspaper without being affected by Greco-Roman education, because we write in a Greco-Roman style, even when we write in our own local dialect. Concerning our ideas of law and justice, as I have mentioned before, we actually live within Roman culture, something also antiquated. The culture of Rome is alive in our laws. Occasionally, the old common law still struggles against that of Rome, but without success. People should feel that what officials now refer to as just and unjust is simply the glimmer of the now far distant past. Only in economics do we live in the present. That says a great deal, and therefore there is much we need to change. If I may make an aside here, many women use modern concepts, but they use them only in cooking, that is, in managing the household. To that extent, they are actually people of the present. Everything else we bring into the present is outdated. I am not saying that the conceptual aspect of cooking is a particularly desirable goal, but it is definitely not very desirable that modern women also leave the present and return to the cultures of antiquity. Therefore, when we look at what exists within our culture, we have to look not only at those things active in space, but also at those acting out of the distant past. If you develop a feeling for that, you will see how not only the past, but also the future affects us. It is, in fact, our task to allow the future to affect us. Although only a weak awareness of it exists, we would certainly be in a very sorry state if every person did not rebel against Greek culture and Roman justice, and if the future could not shine in upon us. To understand our culture, we must take time as well as space into account. We must consider not only what history brings to us from the past, but also the future. We should be aware that to the extent that we are people of the present day, both the past and future play a role in our souls. As Europeans, we need to be aware that not only America, England, Asia, China, and India, not only the two poles of East and West affect us, but Greece, Rome, and the future as well. As we become accustomed to considering how the latter affects us, how the past and future live in our souls, a different soul attitude will arise that goes beyond an egotistical consideration of human fate. An attitude that goes beyond simple spatial considerations will arise. When we have developed that attitude in our souls, we will be capable of developing concepts about the time spirits, the archai. Then we will come to the third level of the divine hierarchy. It would be good if, through the means I just described, people would allow themselves to perceive these three hierarchies in concepts and ideas. The spirits of form that then follow are endlessly more difficult to grasp. It is sufficient for modern people to attempt to penetrate beyond egotism into the realm of the non-egotistical, to try time and again to penetrate what I have just described. That is particularly important for educating teachers. We should not allow teachers to teach before they have gained a concept of the selfishness that strives toward the nearest God, that is, toward the angel. We should not allow teachers to teach before they have achieved an idea of those non-egotistical forces that determine human fate and exist spatially distributed over the earth, that is, of the nature of the archangels. Nor should we allow them to teach before they have gained an idea of how the past and the future affect our culture, how Roman law and the Greek spirit affect us, and how that undefined rebel of the future can save us. Today people have little desire to look at such things. Some time ago I often said that among the social tasks before us is that of taking the content of the education children receive in the upper grades from the present. That is, it is our social task to do just what, in end effect, the Greeks themselves did, namely to take the subject matter from the present. In the same town where I spoke about this and other important social problems, there appeared, soon afterward, I do not want to imply a direct connection, although this is certainly of symptomatic significance, there appeared in all that town's newspapers announcements about the local classical school. Here I had held some lectures describing my thoughts on high school education, and then announcements appeared in the newspaper about how proud we should be of the youth attending that school, about how the education they received, quote, strengthened national consciousness, unquote, and developed, quote, national strength, unquote, and so forth. All this only a few weeks before the Treaty of Versailles. These announcements were signed by all manner of locally renowned people, from the schools and the Department of Education. Unfortunately, what we say from a true basis of human development simply bounces off. People always allow it simply to bounce off them, and it does not touch them in the depths of their souls. That is one of the difficulties in social activity. People will never master our modern social tasks with the prevailing superficial attempts. Questions about the foundation and development of society have deep importance and cannot be answered if people are unwilling to look into the depths of humanity and into the nature of the world. For the very reason that the situation is as it is, you can see the necessity of the changes arising from a threefolding of the social organism. People must develop an organ to sense the needs of our times. It will be difficult to develop such an organ in the spiritual or cultural realm, because, as I have already said, the state has gradually swallowed up cultural development in education. The state has filtered the desire for activity and active striving out of human beings and has made them into dutiful members of the state organization. I think I also posed the question here about how the great majority of people live. There are, of course, exceptions. But until approximately the age of 6, people live unhindered because they are still too dirty for the state. The state is not eager to take on that necessary task with young children. It leaves that task to others. However, afterward, children are taken over by the state and are trained to become proper members of the state and to fit into the molds foreseen for them. Children stop being human and become simply what the state says they are. They then become something for the state. People want that because they are constantly told the state will give them room and board, not only while they work, but even beyond, that they will receive a pension until they die. That is the ideal for many people today, namely to have a position that will later result in a pension. The religions continue in the same direction, promising a pension even after death. That is, the soul receives a right to a pension. People are told that without any activity on their part, their souls will receive immortality simply through the activity of the church. The church will take care of that. Of course, it makes people uncomfortable to hear that they must seek salvation in free spiritual activity, activity that must be independent of the state, and that the state should concern itself only with the rights between people. It makes them uncomfortable to hear that the state will not provide a pension. That causes many people to reject this idea. You can see that again and again. For the most intimate portion of spiritual life, namely religious life, a worldview directed toward the future will require that people earn their immortality, that they allow their souls to be active so that they can receive God and Christ through that activity. I've received many, many letters during my life, often from members of various churches, who say that although anthroposophy is very nice, it contradicts the simple Christian belief that Christ saved human souls, and that through him we can receive eternal salvation with no activity on the part of our souls. They cannot let go of the simple belief in salvation through Christ. People believe that when they say or write such things, they are particularly pious. However, they are simply egotistical. They are selfish, right down to the very foundations of their souls. They desire to do nothing in their souls and to let divinity take care of it, of them, so that their souls receive a wonderful pension on the other side of the pearly gates. It is not so easy in that worldview. that requires us to create a new idea of religion. People must realize that they have to work to understand the divine in their souls. They cannot just passively subjugate themselves to churches that promise to take care of their souls. Something that once caused distress, but that is no longer practiced, namely, caring for the soul in return for money, still plays a hidden role. What we need but do not particularly love is to move toward inner activity and toward a life connected with all creation, of which we count ourselves a part. To acquire a feeling for what we need in this area, we must see some of the things I mentioned today in our souls. We must recognize the metamorphosis of human beings since the time of the ancient Egyptians. We must understand that at that time the body had more of a plant-like nature, so that when our bodies today fall back into that state, they become ill and cause the growth of cancerous tumors. We must understand that we carry a corpse around with us. Through such things we can gain a feeling for what humanity needs, namely to truly move forward regarding the questions of society. We can no longer allow ourselves to view the problems of society in the most simplistic manner. That is one of the most difficult things today. You must be aware that one of the greatest modern difficulties is people's desire to have some of the most important questions about life explained to them in a few abstract sentences. If something like my book titled Towards Social Renewal contains more than a few abstract sentences, if it contains the results of observing life, then people say they do not understand it. It even seems confused to them. However, the misfortune of the present day is that people have no desire to examine those things in need of examination. Abstract sentences that are quite transparent concern only death. However, what is social is living. We must have flexible points of view. We must use flexible sentences. We must create flexible forms. That is why, as I have often said, we should not consider simply a change in particular conditions, but instead we must get used to rethinking and relearning the innermost connections of our thinking and reflecting. Now that I will be leaving for a few weeks, that is the thought I wish to leave with you. That is where we need to feel ourselves in our common anthroposophical and social activity. I want more and more understanding to arise about how anthroposophy is to enter into human souls, if we are to achieve anything in the social realm. I hope you can carry in your hearts something I have often said in various ways. We need to recognize the knowledge we can gain through anthroposophy as the true measure of our activities and desires of the present, and we need the courage to instill anthroposophy into them. The worst thing is that modern people have so little courage to really comprehend what is necessary. They allow the best forces of their wills to collapse. They have no desire to act, necessary though that is. You should learn to represent anthroposophy with courage so that people will look upon our building here, the representative of our spiritual desires, with interest. Take joy in each individual who shows even a little understanding. Meet that person. Do not take it to heart if you are met by people of ill will or, what occurs more often, by people lacking understanding. What is important is to have the courage to continue. We should consider ourselves a small group destined by fate to know certain things and to give those things so needed in today's world. People may laugh at us and say that is presumptuous. It is nevertheless true. To say to ourselves, "It is nevertheless true," in all seriousness, so that truth fills your soul, requires the inner courage we must have. May that permeate us as the substance of anthroposophy. Then we will do what we need to do, each of us in our own place. That is what I want to tell you today. The fact is that, in a sense, we want to wish ourselves past each day that brings us closer to the activity we will achieve for the world through our building here. This building is the only building that in its form takes the destiny of humanity into account. We can rejoice in the fact that there is some attention given to it. However, More is needed for fruitful progress regarding the questions of society. Something like our building, with its stark forms, so different from other modern architectural forms, can spiritually improve the powers of humanity. We want human beings to become open once more for what we want them to know, so that they can rise not only to the angels, but to the archangels and to the spirit of our time. I must now take leave of you for a few weeks. I hope we will then be able to continue this discussion, and that you will continue your energetic activity for our building. You see, my dear friends, it is evident from all sides in the outer world that what human beings need is a desire and willingness to work. They will not have that if they are not convinced of the great goals before them. I believe that when people become convinced, they can achieve an existence more worthy of a human being through the three-folding of the social organism. They will again begin to work. I'm going to read that sentence again. I didn't read it quite right. I believe that when people become convinced they can achieve an existence more worthy of a human being through the three-folding of the social organism, they will again begin to work. Otherwise, they will only continue to strike. People today need such a desire, need such a motive that grips them in the depths of their souls. That is true in the area of physical work. We will not be able to give modern humanity a motive to spiritually overcome what is simply dead if we do not show that our work on at least one object can be fruitful and shine out into the world. Please consider that until we meet here, and can speak together again. Auf Wiedersehen. With these words, Rudolf Steiner left Dornach to travel to Stuttgart, where 2 days later he began the cycle of lectures and seminars that serve as the foundation for Waldorf school pedagogy. That's the end of Lecture 6 and the end of Part 1 of Education as a Force for Social Change.